This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Terra Nova Earth Talks. We speak with cutting-edge experts and wise elders from across the globe on the issues and action our Earth is calling for. Brought to you by the Terra Nova Foundation, driving environmental change through human connection and collective action.
The following was recorded at the Te Ao Earth Week 2023 event in Otatahi Christchurch, with thanks to the Terra Nova Foundation.
I have the great pleasure of introducing Dr. Rod Carr, who is chair of the Climate Change Commission, He Puarangi. He has extensive experience in both public and private sector governance and leadership. He served as chair and non-exec director of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand and as the deputy governor and, for a time, acting governor of the bank. Dr. Carr was the founding chair of the National Infrastructure Advisory Board and for over a decade was the non-exec director of the Canterbury Employers Chamber of Commerce. He led the University of Canterbury as a vice-chancellor for 10 years and holds a PhD in insurance and risk management, an MA in applied economics. I'm still going, right? and managerial science, an MBA in money and finance, and an honours degree in law and economics. How's that to kick off the day? So it's a great pleasure to bring to the podium today Dr. Rod Carr.
And a mana ina iwi tēnā koutou katoa, ko Rod Carr aho. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you. Today I am going to focus on Canterbury, the region. But to understand Canterbury, we do need to back up the bus. We need to understand the context of the transition that we are already in. The climate is changing, ready or not. Averages are really unhelpful in describing what is going on. We hear a lot about the talk to hold average global temperature rises to 1.5 degrees, or certainly below 2 degrees. Why 2 degrees? Because if we bust through 2 degrees, it'll be the first time in 300 million years that it's been warmer than that on average on this planet's surface. But averages tell you nothing about the frequency and severity of the weather you will experience as human beings in a place. It's estimated that if planetary temperatures break through 2 degrees, the average temperature in the upper northern hemisphere will have risen by between 6 and 8 degrees. If we knock on anything resembling 2 degrees, it is estimated there will be 50 days a year in Sydney over 40 degrees centigrade, and 55 degrees experienced in Dubai for 40 days a year. Averages hide the reality that climate is dynamic. It is experienced locally. And we know what it is experienced in. It is experienced in wind and rain and floods and droughts and fires, in sea level rise and ocean acidification. The science is done. We know what happens. The policies to both reduce, but more importantly, learn to live in the climate-changed world we are creating are also pretty nearly known. The trouble now is human behaviour and action. So let's talk about the policies. Presently, global emissions have yet to peak. We're knocking on gross global emissions of 55 billion tonnes of greenhouse gases in GWP 100 terms per annum. 55 billion tonnes. How big a number is that? It's kind of hard to imagine what that number is. Well, the fires in Canada, you know, those ones that have burnt an area the size of the South Island of New Zealand, get that, are estimated to have released about 1.5 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide, less than 3% of global annual human emissions. We have figured out how to terraform on a scale that is terrifying. We also know what we have to do to stop this. We have to stop the combustion of fossil fuels in the open air. 80% of the greenhouse gases are emitted by that practice alone. If we don't fix that, it really doesn't matter what we do in agriculture or other sources of emissions. 80% of the coal burnt today, literally this day, is used to make one third of all the electricity produced on the planet today. And there are known technologies to make that number zero. We don't need to invent anything new. We have to figure out how to rapidly, at pace and scale, take up known technologies. Don't wait for magic, fairy dust, and flu power. We have the technology. We need to be very clear about what the barriers are that are holding us back. Some are regulatory, some are financial, some are the technical skills that we need. Some of them are, quite frankly, our own hubris and human behaviour. The institutional arrangements that create powerful vested interests that have less incentive to change. New Zealand has known policies that will achieve net zero by the middle of this century. We just have to choose whether we are going to do that. And there are four domains where action needs to happen in New Zealand. We need to double the amount of renewable electricity that we generate as soon as we can. Because our pathway to decarbonisation is through electrification. Currently, only 40% of all the energy we use in New Zealand comes from renewable sources. Don't focus or feel satisfied with the near 90% of electricity that comes from renewable sources. Focus on the fact that less than half of all the energy we use comes from renewable resources. In Canterbury alone, pick this region, we spend $800 million a year on liquid petroleum products, which is a transfer of wealth and resource from the Canterbury region, in part to Wellington, because half of that is made up of taxes, levies, and charges. And the other half goes to foreign countries, some of whose principles and practices we may not necessarily adopt as our own. So as a region, if you've got $800 million of purchasing power on the table to keep in the region by weaning ourselves rapidly off liquid fossil fuels, largely used in transport, sooner is better for us. If we move from the simple renewable energy equation, where New Zealand's Infrastructure Commission has estimated that this country has 3 times the potential renewable energy generation capacity, 3 times the potential than we need this century to decarbonize, how do we turn that potential into actual faster, sooner? Solar, wind, run-of-the-river hydro are all credible options that are commercially feasible in this region today. Of course, incumbents would rather that new generation was created just a minute too late rather than just a minute too soon. And we need to have a regulatory environment that encourages the delivery of abundant renewable electricity within this region just ahead of demand. When we have that abundance in plan and confidence it will come, we can decarbonize low and medium temperature process heat with known technologies. Don't need to invent anything new. We can move to transport, but merely replacing fossil fuels in individually owned and operated vehicles that are used 4% of their available time places a demand on the resources of the planet and on our household budgets that is avoidable if we build out other forms of shared, reliable, convenient, and accessible transport, some of which may be publicly funded, not all of which needs to be. But the idea that just because we have reduced emissions from motor vehicles, we should now continue to build out our infrastructure to support privately owned and operated and grossly underutilized assets is not to understand the whole problem. While we're on the topic of transport, we struggle to get the mode shift we need. And while the focus is on mode shift for us as people, mode shift into walking, cycling, and shared transport, one of the bigger challenges is the gross mispricing of land freight transport. When you do the physics, what you understand is if you double the weight in a vehicle, you increase by a factor of 16 the damage it does accelerating, braking, and cornering. The cost of the roads you need to build and the cost of maintenance to maintain roads for heavy freight, if priced appropriately, would solve much of the cost of intermodal shift to rail. And far from making rail look like a basket case, it would make rail look like an extraordinary sensible way to move heavy freight both within a region and between regions. So there is much work to do in the regulatory environment around transport, rather than merely assuming that cycleways alone are a solution to the challenge we face. Of course, we can't have a sensible conversation about emissions unless we have a conversation about agriculture. About half of the greenhouse gas emissions measured the way the world has chosen to measure come from agriculture in New Zealand and indeed within this region. Largely, but not entirely, from ruminant pastoral livestock, the production of meat and milk protein, only a fraction of which is consumed either within this region or at a national level by New Zealand. There are six things that are going to reduce agricultural emissions. The first one of which is land use change, which is already underway. And some of that is driven by the marginal profitability or lack of it in some types of meat production. Not only will land use change push for more effective use of our land, but we are seeing breeding practices that can select for the trait of more efficient conversion of dry matter into meat and milk protein. That breeding is being taken up by our farmers and will reduce agricultural emissions by between 1 and 2% per annum. But there will be limits to how efficiently you can breed. Feeding practices can make an enormous difference on farm. One portfolio of 1,500 dairy farms shows that the average greenhouse gas emissions per kilo of milk protein produced is about 10 kilograms of greenhouse gases. But the 20% highest polluting emitting have an average of 15 kilograms of greenhouse gases per kilo of milk protein. In other words, they're 50% worse for the same output. Why? Some of it is the land that is being farmed, some of it is the grasses that are being grown, some of it is the farm management practices on farm. So breeding, feeding, and land use change will affect the supply side of our agricultural emissions. Notice I didn't say pricing. But also what we are going to face internationally is changing consumer preferences, alternative technologies, and foreign regulators. Let's tick them off. 30% of the UK population under the age of 30 eat red meat rarely, if ever. And they are our future consumers. 17% of adults in New Zealand now eat red meat rarely, if ever. And that proportion grows by about 3 percentage points a year. In addition to changing consumer preferences, we have the retailers like Tesco's wanting to position themselves as the credible and trusted agent for those who buy from them. Rather than getting the customer to read the labels with the three green trees, Tesco's are positioning themselves to say, we will stock only the products which have the lowest environmental footprint for that product type. We will shop the world, trust us, if it's on the shelf, it's the best it can be. The challenge we face now is that there are feed supplements approved and being used in Europe and North America that require daily feeding to barn-raised beef and dairy herds that reduce methane emissions by 30 to 60%. Our 10% reduction by 2030 is, in my view, completely achievable and utterly irrelevant. Finally, alternative technologies will emerge. In part, they will emerge because parts of the world is going to prove to be extremely difficult to create agricultural products from outdoors. Controlled growing environments are going to become a necessity, both for the management of environmental impacts, but also as a first line of defence against the climate change we have created. At the moment, those controlled growing environments do not yet pose a credible threat at scale to the way we currently produce meat and milk protein. But there are billions of dollars of investments being made in the name of food security around the world, because long and vulnerable supply lines for meat and milk protein expose some of our most valuable markets to what they perceive to be the insecurity of supply chains. We need to work with our farming communities to find business models that support communities, create meaningful and profitable use of land to provide the goods and services with low environmental impacts that the world is going to want. Because trust me, it's not about a green premium. The challenge will be that we cannot supply the world at a dirty discount. And if we are locked into producing products and services, whether it's long-haul, short-stay tourism, or some of our other high-emitting products, we will find ourselves supplying the products and services that only the poor people will want, but will not be able to afford. I'm optimistic for Canterbury as a region and for New Zealand. The idea of carbon zero by 2045 is a luxury we do not have. It fails to recognise the transition that is already underway, but it also fails to recognise the enormous opportunities for a healthier, less vulnerable, more sustainable, and much more attractive place to live and work. All of the people in this room can play their part. Each of us in our own right is both a barrier to someone else's action and an enabler for someone else's action. Take the time today to be honest with yourself and those you talk to about how you are a barrier, and encourage them to understand how you could be an enabler. The transition to a more sustainable economy is underway. It's not about our unborn children. It's not about obligations under the Paris Agreement. It's about opportunities for us now. Kia ora.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Terra Nova Earth Talks. For more information on the content and links from this podcast, go to the Terra Nova website. That's terranova.foundation. To listen to other interviews in this series, go to the Plains FM website. That's plainsfm.org.nz. Search for Terra Nova Earth Talks. Also on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Bye for now.